You are listening to a special episode of the Vital Masculinity Podcast. In just a couple of days, on November 3rd, 2020, we in the U.S. will be having an election. So Stephen and I decided to invite Nick Jamel of Conversation of Our Generation on to discuss politics. Why are they so contentious and polarized? What does it look like to have a discussion on important issues with people you disagree with? We'll be talking about these things and more on this episode. Now, don't worry, we're not getting into any nitty-gritty details of this current election. So whether you live in a different country or you're listening to this at a later date, or if you have different political views from us, it will still be relevant for you because we're not really getting into the issues. We're really just focusing on how to have a conversation virtuously. So let's get on with it.
Pull up a seat, grab a beer. The Vital Masculinity Podcast is finally here. And boy, you're going to need the beer because we are going to be talking about politics tonight. And we have a very special guest on, Nick Jamel. I feel like we've been having a lot of conversations with you, Nick. How's it going, man?
It's good. It's good. I wasn't sure if this is the Vital Masculinity Podcast or the night before Christmas. I wasn't quite sure what we were going for, but I like it.
The rhyme was natural, but honestly, I put much more thought in than I probably should have. So, Brian, what are we talking about tonight, and why are we drinking in decently copious amounts?
Well, we are talking about politics. I guess, in particular, something that I think is right down Nick's alley, having conversations about politics, because... you know, you're the conversation of our generation, so you know what's going on.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, at least I hope I do.
I feel like nowadays everyone is just making stuff up, and if they say they have everything figured out, they're probably bullshitting you. I mean, that's life in general, but nowadays especially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's times where I just have to check myself every now and then, because I'm like, I know I have a podcast, and so when I'm listening to other people, like on podcasts or somewhere else, I'm like, how much does this person actually know? Because any Joe Schmo can kind of do this and just put out stuff. So, yeah, it's definitely, you got to kind of, I don't know, I try to keep myself a little bit, you know, in check and just make sure that I'm not overstepping my bounds because I know how little I know. That's for sure.
You know, I think that brings up an interesting question because, you know, you're talking about trying to really think outside the box and just look beyond what people are saying or in many cases nowadays tweeting or posting on Facebook or the internet. So how do you, in the age of people putting out accusations of fake news and, you know, like gaslighting and things like that, how do you walk that line between taking someone at their word and being like just too cynical or just, you know, like not trusting anything you're seeing?
Yeah. I would say that I kind of have I take the Ronald Reagan approach, the trust but verify, you know, for people who over time have again and again proved to me that they are reliable people, I'm willing to give them a benefit of a doubt. If it's someone that I don't know about, then I'm going to be a little more hesitant. And and I don't really put a ton of credit with, you know, you have CNN or Fox News next to your name or some big accredited thing. I think that that's not necessarily where we find a lot of truth. And instead, I really look to where, I guess, how does this person's ideas or what they're saying line up with, you know, my gut instinct of, you know, you can just kind of check things. And when someone says something, you can kind of say, yeah, that just kind of sounds like very improbable. And unless they have enough evidence to back up something that's incredibly improbable, then I try to kind of hold off judgment and wait till the evidence comes out. But that's the other thing is I just think that getting both sides of the story, listening to podcasts, going to the New York Times, because I don't think I could listen to, you know, hours of people, you know, bashing kind of my point of view on things, but I will read or check articles and stuff like that that give you the other side of things. And I think that once you start to get, if you just pull from a bunch of different sources, you can kind of piece together, okay, if this person who doesn't want this to be true is admitting it's true, then that's probably a pretty good indicator. If this person's kind of, you know, playing down something, but admitting it, you know, you can say maybe that's reliable information at that point. But yeah, it's tough. I think it's, we all have that tendency to just like see O'Keefe break something with Project Veritas and be like, yes, now you got them, like red-handed or whatever it is. And I think that there've been times where I've caught myself like putting something out there and like, oh, I overstepped, or I jumped the gun on it a little bit. But especially with like all the videos that come out with like, you know, the kid at Macy's, that guy at Macy's, like beating up the, you know, the clerk or whatever he was, and just all of those like a minute long video, I just like, no, I'm not going to make a judgment on this until we have reporting. Like, they have police reports probably somewhere for this. Those will come out. You look at that. Like, you could look at this and say, this looks bad, this looks not so great. But I think that that is one thing I've definitely moved towards, is just holding out a judgment until you have all the facts.
I was listening to Mike Pompeo. I forget what his specific position is.
Secretary of State.
Yeah, Secretary of State. And he was, he quoted Reagan, but he said, I think he was talking in context of like China. And he said that he prefers to take the approach, distrust but verify, which I feel like that's kind of how millennials and the younger generations tend to approach like mainstream media with CNN and Fox. And I don't know, maybe it's just me because I'm more pessimistic, but I almost feel like I'm more likely to trust a smaller source than like one of these big corporations that, you know, supposedly I'm supposed to trust them because they're fair and balanced, or you know, they have won some sort of prize in journalism.
I think that that's definitely a good point. I think that like places like the Daily Wire for me are somewhere that I know where they stand. I know what kind of they're coming at these stories, like the angle that they're bringing and the point of view that they have when they come to this. And so I know that I'm going to get information skewed a certain way, and I can account for that sort of in my calculation of, okay, how truthful is this thing? I know even between the different hosts that I listen to, you know that Ben Shapiro and Michael Knowles come from different backgrounds and have a different take on things, and have, you know, Michael Knowles is definitely very much more of a Trump booster and I kind of take his Trump news with a little bit more of a grain of salt than something that Shapiro says. And I think that the other good thing that those smaller things have is they have to continually earn your trust. That's really what those types of things are built on so much more, because they're still new. They still, I mean, Fox News, CNN, they are around and they're going to be around for a while because they are behemoths, right? They're not beholden to earning your trust at this point anymore. And so I like looking for those outlets that have to still and are not so big that they can just do whatever they want, regardless of what, you know, their audience or their listenership is, what's in their best interest, at least.
There's definitely a self-perpetuating cycle of almost fear, but I almost want to say it's caused by greed. And I think you hit the nail on the head, Nick, because it's really the life cycle of any company. When you're just starting out, well, like, let's just take Apple or the tech industry, you really have to prove your worth, because no one's going to invest, except for in the case of like Theranos, like billions and billions of dollars into an unproven either person or product or idea, or just the entire package of that. So having that incentive of actually producing a good product is what drives these people on both the right, left, and middle, and everywhere else in between. You know, like, and I think that's a very, very good point. The issue, and I don't think there's really any way around this, is at some point it kind of like oversaturates. And I don't want to say that, like, I don't like that phrase that, you know, power corrupts. I think that that is too blanket of a statement. And I think there's great examples throughout history that disprove that being kind of a theorem or heuristic. But I do believe that, you know, there is that incentive to, you know, when you have power, or in this case, when you have like market saturation, to either, you know, become a little more corrupt, to sell out, or even just to like you know, settle in ways that you may not have previously settled, because you're trying to, at this point, not just produce the news and get viewers, but also you're trying to live up to expectations that you set either internally or have been set on you externally, that in many ways, like, kind of keep going and going and going. Like, for instance, Tucker Carlson, who just broke another record I saw before the show of 5.2 million viewers the past, I want to say, week or so, you know, per night. That creates a very big goal target for next week and next week. Because if you get back down to, you know, 4 million or 3 million or whatever, that shows that you are doing probably something wrong. So there becomes that incentive, whether you take, whether he or anyone else takes it or not, to become more sensational. And that's really what I think the 24/7 news cycle is perpetuated on.
I agree. I think that it's the same thing for any, really any businesses. You have to hit growth metrics. It's our economy is built on the fact that you're getting a certain level of growth year over year, and all of those growths in the size of the show is more ability to sell more expensive ad spots, which is how they make their money. So they do have to grow listenership, and that's what I try to do. I mean, I'm trying to grow my listenership. I'm trying to grow the number of, you know, people hitting my website and all that. But I think that you can still do that in a way that is honest and true to what you believe. And I think that the kind of podcast smaller arena, this newer space where we're seeing kind of this different type of, like, new alternative media come up, is a place where that can happen. I think, you know, if you look back to our founding fathers, they had pamphlets and they had other ways of distributing things that was kind of that technological medium of the time. And they took advantage of it and they put out their ideas in a way that's honest and kind of subverting the general power structures that were there. And, you know, TV came along and did that as well, actually, at some point. But it's become sort of old and as like an ossified. And how often do you guys watch the news with intent to, like, I mean, rarely probably get, no, especially in, out of our friend group, how many people our age are out there watching this? I mean, the only people I know are my parents' age or older, for the most part, who are regularly watching and consuming news that way.
I mean, I don't have cable, so I don't watch cable news. Maybe I might watch like clips from cable news on YouTube or something, but even then, it's usually if I'm on YouTube, I'm watching, like, I don't know, the Daily Wire or some other small outlet that has, interesting commentary or some take that they can add to the it's not just the stereotypical news hour or whatever you want to think of it. Although, to be honest, I think even on the regular cable stations, it seems like it's mostly, you know, talking heads, people, you know, so-called experts giving their opinions on everything. And it's, I don't know, I was just thinking about, like, it's, whether it's a small news outlet or the huge news, or even if you're just getting your news from social media or Twitter or whatever it is, it seems to be, what's the word? Maybe you might call it totalitarian. It's like not like a government, like, controlling sense, but it's like completely taking over, like, every aspect of life, where it's inserting itself into everything that we do. And the reason I'm thinking of this is because I'm reading Rod Dreher's new book, Live Not by Lies, and one of the things that Hannah Arendt, she wrote a book about totalitarianism. She was talking about how they described it in I think it was Mussolini and the fascists in Italy were talking about totalitarianism. Totalitarianism is like making the personal political, so everything becomes political. And it just seems like everything is political and everything is constantly on the news. And I feel like it causes at least people with conservative views to walk on eggshells, because, you know, whenever I want to talk about something, I'm like self-consciously like, okay, who's around? Like, is there going to be some person that's going to come like try to burn down my house after I say what I really think? And it's, yeah, I don't know. It just seems like, you know, it's not really Big Brother, but I think just constant news and constant people talking about making everything political, it makes a very unpleasant experience to live in.
I do think that there's a natural outgrowth of the personal being political. I talked about this recently on one of my podcast episodes, is that all of my political beliefs boil down to a deeply held personal belief in some way, shape, or form. And so, you know, when I take my personal belief and I exchange that idea with other people, and now we're deciding, okay, we have a bunch of us together, how do we live together in a society? Now that personal belief of how I should live my life, or how I should be allowed to live my life, maybe how I shouldn't be murdered, how I shouldn't be stolen from, or how I shouldn't steal in return, like those kinds of questions are personal beliefs that now have to be worked out in a political sphere. I think it's when, it's not that everything becomes like, I think that it's when, yes, everything becomes political, where, like, you know, the NBA doesn't have to be political, right? Sports do not have to be a like a political question. There are times where, you know, you can look at, you know, Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier, people like that, like making political statements. But for the most part, it should be kind of the place where I don't have to worry about that, right? This isn't a serious question. We shouldn't be. I think it's when it pervades every aspect of your culture that it just gets tiring and annoying in a lot of ways.
In many ways, it comes across to me as almost, and yeah, I know we're in an election cycle and we've been steeped in it for not just a couple of weeks, but really at this point, like a year and a half, let's be honest. It almost becomes like an outsourcing of personal responsibility, even for people on the right that would, you know, very, in my opinion, rightfully so, shun, you know, things like welfare programs and things like that, at least to a certain extent. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I follow a lot of people on Twitter. Basically, if you go to my Twitter, it's probably 75% right now, like followers or people I follow are like electoral politics statisticians and, you know, analysts and things like that. And other 25% are like masculinity related or personal stuff. So even though we're doing a vital masculinity thing, I'll say public Twitter is still very related to the process. And I find so many people, including myself at times, that, you know, make the results of any election seem life or death. And I mean, I don't want to blame it on Twitter. I don't want to blame it on social media. And honestly, Brian, we really need to get a bell for every time like I blame social media. I think I did it like 10 times last episode that we recorded. But like, it's an issue. It really is an issue in our society, because you have one side that sees, you know, one person as, you know, in many ways the savior of issues X, Y, and Z, or of the country or whatever. And you have the other side as the defeater of the savior or the champion of these issues. And it brings up, you know, the question of competing moralities and things like that. But at the end of the day, it's kind of like we had with Colin in our recent piece on the Journal about the real issue behind all of our social division and all of our political division. And it's because people aren't focusing the time and energy on becoming virtuous men and women. And they're not really focusing the time and energy even on their communities. Like, I think local politics is great if you want to have a great involvement in, but seeing people get this over, like, you know, people that live in, say, North Carolina, like myself, get this just analytical for fun in a way about, say, like the voting patterns of Bucks County, Pennsylvania, and the effects of, you know, like a couple inches of rain. Like, I've seen that analysis, and it's fun, but it's weird. You know, in many ways, it reminds me of, like, you know, counting all your steps. Like, what does it really matter if you take 10,500 steps versus 10,501 steps? I think in many ways, it just makes these people feel better. And it's a way to kind of, like I said before, like outsource the personal responsibility of solving the problems in your own life.
Yeah, I definitely think that we, you know, in the 60s, there was a push to make the personal the political. And I think that it was an effort to bring those discussions to every aspect of our life, so that, because if, you know, for instance, with the abortion debate, if it is really just a clump of cells and getting rid of the pregnancy is no big deal, well, then conservatives who are pro-life are tyrants. And if, you know, that is actually a baby, and which I believe, in the mother's womb that you are killing, then, you know, people, that's, we're sanctioning mass murder and genocide. So that is a serious question that I think has incredible repercussions. And so when you have those people coming into office, there's real things at stake. And I think people see that. But the other thing is, I think we tie up ourselves too much. We kind of have this, you know, we put our faith in princes and instead of putting our faith where it should be. And so when Joe Biden fails, or when Donald Trump fails, one of them is going to lose in a couple weeks here, or a week here, actually. Wow. So, well, we might not know for a couple weeks, but, you know, that's going to mean that somewhat, a lot of people, like, it's not just meaningless. You know, it's not just, oh, my team lost, you know, the Colts lost on Sunday, big whoop, we'll get them next week. It's not like that. It does have real repercussions for how we live our lives, but there's so much space for people to improve their lot, regardless of who's in office. I mean, my last 8 years of my life have changed tremendously as I've graduated high school, gone into college, and really, you know, I, once the tax cuts hit, I had more money in my pocket from my check, but really, I was doing a lot of things under Obama to improve my life, and it didn't really matter that much on my day to day, other than how much more there is about, there's a lot more about Donald Trump and politics in my Twitter feed than like there was, you know, 6 years ago when it was mostly Wiz Khalifa and, you know, whatever else, other just random celebrities I was following, because you could actually just stay out of politics on Twitter, believe it or not.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the focus is not on how I can become a more virtuous person, but it's how can I get everyone else to act more virtuously? Like, I don't want to just buy a cup of coffee. I want to buy a cup of coffee from a place that supports causes that I like, or that maybe doesn't support causes that I don't like. You know, I want to get a chicken sandwich from a place that makes me feel good about, you know, paying for this chicken sandwich. And I just found myself thinking about this like the other day, like, I feel like I'm evaluating everything like, okay, if I buy these types of foods at the store, like, what does that say about me as a person? Or if I go to Starbucks, does that mean that I am pro-abortion? Or like, if I go to Chick-fil-A, does that mean that I'm, you know, some fundamentalist Christian? Like, and I feel like we've I guess that's kind of what I mean by making the personal political. It's like, can this just be a cup of coffee? Can this just be a chicken sandwich? Why does it have to be something else? It seems like, you know, the clothes you buy, the car you drive now, the food that you buy, everything has to have a political statement to it. And I feel like when it's like we're focusing on what all these different companies are doing, it's kind of giving us the excuse to say, I don't have to worry about myself. All I just need to do is find the company that's going to support the cause that I believe in. And then, you know, by supporting them, I'm somehow a good person.
I think the issue is really that as much as I want to believe that this is basically a generational issue and whether we could just blame millennials or blame boomers or blame Gen X or whatever, I think the result or the actions that we're seeing now, the results of decades, if not ultimately centuries of moral decay, and not just moral decay, but I would say societal decay in a way that makes people want to turn to politics or turn to like strongmen like Donald Trump or whatever it may be, or even heck, turn to corporations. Let's be honest, like in your example, Brian, that's what a lot of people do. I've been to Whole Foods. I know what it's like. You know, these people, they turn to them as really a refuge from how crappy their lives are because they don't feel like they can produce change in their own life. And I think that's actually an interesting thing because this gets back to kind of the question that you and I and Nick talked about on his show about like the point of justice and how we view justice, particularly in this very polarized society that we have now and with this word being so charged. And it's all striking because you have so many people that are identifying actual issues. They're identifying actual issues with police officers, identifying actual issues with the way the economy works. They're identifying actual issues with, you know, our office 9-to-5 job and the tedium that results in it. And as much as I wish I could go to someone, because I think at the end of the day, particularly, you know, even with you added, Nick, I feel like even though we're in three different states, we still kind of represent a certain strata of the population. It would be very hard for me to say go to like Trump's rally in Michigan or Pennsylvania or like the Rust Belt and be like, you should just work on becoming more virtuous when they have actual, like physical, actual real struggles. And I'm not saying that they should put off the, you know, the path of virtue, because that is obviously something you should always be striving towards, let's be honest. But I think that, you know, and I don't want to put aside the fact that there are actually people that are hurting. And that's something that, like, you know, I don't experience, thank God, and glory be to God for that. But it's something that, you know, is very real. And whether it's a perceived hurt or a perceived level of gaslighting or perceived level of, you know, victimhood or whatever, or people are legitimately struggling with things like opium or, you know, job loss or whatever, it makes it a lot harder, I think, to address these issues because you almost really need to sell the path of virtue. Because again, you know, it would be one thing if it was like your grandfather did this, but I don't even know if I would say that like our grandparents were necessarily all that virtuous compared to maybe their grandparents or things like that, you know. And this gets into the topic of ideals and things like that. But at the end of the day, it's a very difficult question. And it makes a lot of sense to me, at least, why the political arena is becoming so, I'll say, vital to people's existence in a way.
Yeah, I think we've taken away a lot of agency from people to be able to affect that change in their own life. I mean, if you remember the like controversy a few years back about the whole learn to code thing, like they were telling, like it got, I think that phrase got banned on Twitter because they were like all those journalists, you know, they were just like trolling all the people getting laid off and all the journalist people and saying, you should just learn to code. And I agree. We should be teaching people how to code. I mean, I work in an industry I work for a company where we partner with coding boot camps and stuff to get their people placed, to get more people to know about these opportunities. And there's a lot of stuff that is doing, I mean, we're going to have to increase the number of coders in our country by a couple million to meet the way our economy is shifting. But are you going to tell that to the guy who's worked in the auto factory his whole life? I mean, I worked at a retail store that was in one of those auto towns that had factories pulled out from under it, and now there's a lot less there. You have to go to the next town in Indiana to find, you know, those good factory jobs that were here in abundance not that long ago. That said, the Nestle plant that was right there still had hundreds, maybe even 1,000 jobs or something like that, that were going unfilled, and people weren't taking them, you know, 4 years ago when I was there. So there's a lot of real problems. And I think that there's a lot of stuff that we just kind of have ignored a lot of those issues. And that's why I think Trump has done well, is because he spoke to people who I know felt ignored. And I don't think any of these people, and that's where I still, like, even the Daily Wire guys who have been on the coast their whole lives, I think they have a better idea of what's going on because they come to see these areas. But as someone who lives not that far from this stuff, who's, you know, my father-in-law works in a steel mill here in Indiana in this Rust Belt area. Like, these are serious things that affect people that I know, and I see it firsthand. And so there are political solutions to personal problems sometimes, but I think that putting everything in that, all your eggs in that basket, is what causes so much anger, because then it's not just an affront to for me, I'm very detached from my political beliefs in that sense. Like, if you don't agree with me, or if we have a political discussion and we disagree. I'm like, cool, that's fine. You have your opinion, I have mine. If you're going to vote a way that I wouldn't vote, that's fine. Like, that's not like a personal affront to me. But I do see people who sort of have that sensibility. And I think it's wrong. I think that that's something that people should work on, trying to kind of detach. But I also understand why that might be the case on both sides of the political aisle.
How do you approach those types of conversations? Because, I don't know, maybe I just spend too much time on Twitter, although I don't really spend that much time on there. But I get the impression that people feel like, okay, if you don't agree with me, then you're either Hitler or Stalin. You know, either you're on the far left or the far right, and I guess you could argue whether or not they're on the left and the right. But, like, you're an evil person because you oppose my political views. And I don't know, that just it seems more common. Do you think it's more common today? And how do you deal with having conversations with people that feel that way about perhaps what you think?
Well, my favorite, so I remember one time I had someone, like, I said something and they just like tweeted, you know, replied with like a picture of Hitler. And I was like, really? So what makes me Hitler? Like, I just asked the question. I was like, and this was very, very early on with the conversation. I mean, this was a couple of years ago. But I was just like, how am I like Hitler? Like, what did I say that was like what he says? And the person was like, and then really they kind of said something like, oh, well, you said this. It wasn't, you know, they kind of backtracked a little bit when you call them on it. And after that, you know, we kind of had a charitable conversation and he said, here's something that you did say that was wrong. And I said, oh, okay, thank you. I appreciate that. I guess I probably should have used this word instead, and kind of went back and forth. I think that the big thing that you have to do is approach people charitably, even if they're not being charitable towards you, and just say, okay, look, I can see why you feel that way. Or, hey, tell me why it is that you feel that way. I just want to understand. And I think that when you come at someone with, I want to understand your point of view, rather than I want to undermine your point of view, or I want to get my jabs in and be right, I think that that helps put people's guard down and allow them to really open up on why it is that they believe what they do. And sometimes when you ask them to describe what it is that they believe in, then they realize that they don't go as far down as those beliefs don't go as far down as they thought. That's why I started this. Was I knew why I was for low taxes. I knew why I had a couple of ideas, but then I was like, when I got down to it, I was like, wait, why do I believe that? What is at the root of that? How do I get to that idea? And in exploring that, I realized maybe these talking points that I've been spitting back at people are not necessarily productive, A, or B, the full picture of what I believe. And so when you ask people those questions, I think trying to honestly understand them, you're going to get to something at least substantive, even if it may not be fully all the way there.
I guess a good follow-up question that your statement brings, because I agree with you 100%, and I think that that's something that as people that are trying to be virtuous, people that are trying to just be men, I mean, heck, you know, Nick, you and I are married. I'm sure, you know, I sometimes have to try to understand our wives in ways than maybe our gut reaction tells us to. And that definitely makes our lives a lot more peaceful, glory to God. But the thing for me is, you know, like I've watched a lot of people on YouTube that do a lot of the things. Like, you know, we mentioned the Daily Wire a lot. You have people like Steven Crowder that do a lot of the Change My Mind. And yeah, some of it's theatrics, and some of it's also people that are young that may not have their beliefs formed. Although the latter, I think, is still a serious issue. But you do have people that are unwilling to maybe not even change their mind, like Crowder would say, but maybe just examine their beliefs or examine the roots of their beliefs, whether it's something background, whether it's just educational, whether it's just, you know, they're parroting something. And my question would be to you is, you know, there are unfortunately, or as it seems, there are a lot of people like that on social media. I don't want to say the word, like, you know, out there in society, in our communities, but at least on social media, there are a lot of people that are like that. And you could spend time trying to figure things out with these people and to actually have genuine conversations with them, which I think would be a good thing. But at what point does it become a waste of time trying to do that? Because I guess you could also argue that the opposite of not trying to engage with these people, whether you're trying to, you know, basically create your own, you know, communities that you don't have to deal with it, whether because you just are annoyed by it or whether because it's just too much, like Parler, for instance, you know, like that furthers the polarization. Because if you're not having conversations, whether they're productive or non-productive, it you know, things continue to move further and further apart. So at what point would you cut off the line and say, I need to stop talking to these people because it's not going to work? Or, you know, like, I need to start talking to these people? Because it does seem to be a very fine line to me to walk between furthering polarization and, you know, driving yourself crazy trying to dialogue with people that may not want to dialogue.
Yeah, I think it just depends. You kind of know when a conversation has run its course or is getting to where I find that when I feel myself looping back around, I'm like, okay, we've been to this point before and we're still at the same point with it. It's kind of like, okay, we can see if this has anything here, but if eventually you're just like, we're just running ourselves in circles. There's no sense of me being like, yes, but lower taxes help people, you know, keep more of their own money and are able to do more. And then the person's come back with the same reply that they had last time I explained the economics of it to them or whatever. It, you know, then it's like, okay, fine. We're just not getting anywhere. You know, thanks. I think that there's also a point where, like, there's someone on there that I talk to all the time, the classical conservative. He and I really like to have the back and forth about, like, the fine lines between, you know, kind of the conservative, conservatarian point of, like, view versus, like, a libertarian side of things. And, you know, it's very interesting because I think we both have a lot of charity towards each other's positions, but there's times where I'm like, okay, we're not getting anywhere on this point. We've just gone down this weird rabbit hole of like kind of splitting hairs. And I don't necessarily think this was incredibly productive. And so you just kind of, I don't know, I notice it as I am in the middle of it. But also I think that talking to people on there who seem willing to engage, people who ask questions, people who don't just offer or snark and then kind of go away. That's the kind of people that I try to at least engage with a little bit, because I mean, that's also part of from my brand and what I do. Obviously that's a part of it, but also I think that there's people there that you can learn from. And as long as I think both people in a conversation are learning from each other, it's at least valuable in some way. And I think the biggest thing that I learned is how to have better conversations by learning from mistakes that I have in there as well. So like, that's part of it. But I think the other thing is having real person to person conversations. Like my dad and I, or our neighbors, we'll have a couple beers, you know, friends of mine, you know, you have a couple beers and you have a conversation like we're having here. I think that that's really where headway is made. The reason that I do try to do that in a small amount on Twitter or on Facebook is because you can kind of open people up to a different point of view, maybe open people up to a different way of having those conversations. And hopefully that carries over into your personal life where it can actually take root and make a meaningful difference. Because I think you have, Twitter's just so hard. I always get so lost in the replies where like people like reply twice. I'm like, I'm replying to that point, but that's a separate thread now. And I get so lost and I'm really bad about it. There's times where I'm like, wait, I'm not even replying to the right tweet. Oh gosh. But I think that when you can kind of keep track of a conversation like this and really dialogue back and forth, it's helpful.
This might sound like a dumb question, but how do you start conversations like that? Because I think that myself personally, and I imagine this is probably similar for a lot of people of our generation, is that I feel very isolated from people who don't agree with me. Like most, especially with COVID and social distancing, like the only people I've really seen this year are people that I agree with. Maybe my neighbors, although we kind of just talk about the weather. We don't really talk about anything substantial, but I feel like even growing up when I was a kid, like, you know, I lived in a suburb outside of Syracuse, New York, and you know, we had neighbors, but, you know, you say hi to them when you saw them, but most of the time people just go inside and they're, or they hide out in their backyard or they're watching TV or something. It just, it seems like, at least in my experience, people are not very neighborly. I don't know how to meet people that don't do things that I do. I was living in an apartment building a few years ago, and there was probably about, I don't know, maybe 100 people living in the building. I don't think I saw more than like 4 people the whole time I lived there for like 3 years, like 4 other people that lived in the building. And I think this is perhaps part of the problem, and maybe perhaps why it's seems to be escalating with social distancing, is people just don't get out to talk to other people that they disagree with. And I don't really know where that even happens, especially with someone like me who's a software engineer. And now I can just work from home. You know, we might never go back to the office. Like, how are people going to have these conversations? And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to this question is, but I feel like I'm kind of revealing my own social bubble that I live in right now.
I think it's tough. I think maybe I was kind of put in a unique position growing up, but you know, the neighborhood that I lived in was just kind of this little pocket off of a pretty, you know, minor road in Indianapolis. And you just kind of go in this little cove, and there's just kind of your old, it almost feels like you travel back in time to like the 50s almost, where people just did hang out. Like, even still, like if I go over there on a Friday, my dad and the neighbor are hanging out, having a beer in the driveway, talking. And that's just kind of how I grew up. But they would have conversations, and they all disagree about a lot of things. I mean, there's some people who are, you know, probably more moderate in the middle. Like, you're kind of people who, you're kind of typical independent type person who might have voted for Obama, might have voted for Trump this time around. And then you have kind of both sides of like your staunch Republican, Democrat, either side as well. And so I think that growing up around that, I still have conversations with them about things. My friend group is definitely a mixed bag. I mean, there are friends that I don't really mess with politics with, just because, you know, I think it's more important to just shoot, you know, stuff with friends instead of, you know, worry about that if that's not a productive conversation that you can have. I don't think there's any sense losing a friend over that. You know, same with family. We have like a couple people in our family who disagree with probably the rest of it. It seems like is kind of how it is. And my grandma one time, definitely at Thanksgiving prayer, like was like, okay, I'm so glad we could live in this, even though some of us aren't happy with the current administration, and like points. And I'm like, oh God, like my dad and I'm like looking, he's like mouthing like, what the heck, across the circle. I'm like, yikes. But those things have happened for sure. But I think, you know, we just kind of like stay away from that stuff when it gets heated. But I think for me, I've just kind of had friends who I think are built on having that ability to talk about some of those things. And a lot of it, I think, helps to kind of joke about politics a little bit, to see where people's buttons are too. I think that that's another thing that you know, especially like I'm also kind of, you know, lean libertarian on a lot of things, so it's definitely very easy for me to like poke fun at either side of the political aisle. And as long as you kind of do it to both sides, I think that people's guard goes down and they can talk to you, and they, I feel like both Republicans and Democrats can find common ground with a libertarian minded person, even if I lean maybe more towards one party or the other. But yeah, I do think it's tough, and it's going to get tougher going forward to find actual ways to have in-person conversations in general. And so I think that finding ways to make some of those friends and to kind of see, you know, and also just don't be afraid to, you know, kind of get into the weeds with somebody about it. I think because you'd be surprised sometimes what comes out of a conversation from someone who you think is just like totally believes one way. And then you start talking to them and you're like, oh, you kind of surprise me, or you think about these things in a much more complex way than I just kind of had you patterned out to be. But also I do think that right now it's definitely tough. And with the lockdowns, it's just finding that way to do that in person, I think is hard for sure.
It definitely strikes me, you know, just the importance of having these conversations and having face-to-face communication. I mean, I remember growing up and my parents, you know, doing the old parent adage of, you know, go outside and play with, ride bikes with the neighbor kids and things like that. And I'm glad I did, you know, to the extent that I did, at least. I unfortunately still grew up in a very small neighborhood in kind of like the outskirts, a very, very secluded suburb area. But nevertheless, I mean, it definitely taught me to be able to have these conversations. And I think another point would be able to have thick skin. And it's a very interesting point that like I've been having with, or in a conversation I've been having with my wife about, say, the benefits of homeschooling. And one of the things that I feel like you may not get if you go to public school, and this may be the only benefit, in my opinion, at least, of going to public school, is that you're going to learn to get thick skin probably one way or another. Like, I was bullied. I bullied some other kids. I mean, I regret that. And unfortunately, it was just kind of rampant, at least where I went to middle school and kind of early in high school. But it taught me to be able to disagree with people. And I'll say maybe not in the healthiest of ways, but it at least taught me that there are people with other opinions than me. And I think, you know, I remember, and this meme may be old now, I feel like time has just been moving so fast, but the whole snowflake meme, there are people that genuinely cannot handle disagreement with others. I mean, it's funny, earlier today I was watching a video of someone interviewing like protesters at a Trump rally in Wisconsin or Minnesota or somewhere up in the Rust Belt North. And, you know, these people were very emotional about it. And whether you think that's right for them to be so or wrong, I mean, there was one lady that started crying when she was asked to like defend her belief about abortion, not in a threatening way, not in any way, but like these people, they've never really felt adversity. And whether, you know, you could argue it's more of a woman thing, I mean, I think there are a lot of men that are like it too. The ability to be able to handle stress, the ability to be able to handle other people's opinions is very important. And I think you made a very good point, like, especially with your family, Nick. I mean, it's very important for men and really everybody to be able to have friends and just have relationships with people that are different from you. And whether it's because you're trying to learn from them, or whether you're trying to just understand them, get a different point of view, or even it's just because they're things like family or people you work with or whatever, you in the same way that you and I and Brian would not go around and like bash people over the head with a crucifix and be like, convert or die, you know, we wouldn't go around and be like, you need to vote for Trump or you need to vote for Biden or you're going to hell or, you know, we're going to beat you up or we're never going to talk to you again. And unfortunately, that never going to talk to you again is becoming a, maybe it's a vocal minority now, and I know it's a minority, but it's still growing in kind of clout in a way. And it just, I think, is in many ways just the hallmark of a generation or many generations that do not know how to disagree, that do not know how to deal with relationship trouble. And maybe that explains other things like divorce. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. And I think another thing that we can do on top of that is, if you're trying to get conversations started with people, listening to them, you know, asking, like, because it goes back to the How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, he talked about how one day he didn't know anything about botany. He was at a party. He met a botanist and he just kept asking him all these questions. And he said that, you know, he heard from through the grapevine that botanist said that Dale Carnegie was the best conversationist he'd ever met. He's like, I did nothing but ask him questions all night. He was giving, you know, bearing the brunt of the conversation. He was the one talking about his ideas. So people like to be asked what they believe. People like to talk. I mean, I sit here as I have a podcast and I talk about my ideas a lot. And so, you know, we enjoy doing that. So if you're like not sure where someone stands, I think that as you're creating those relationships, if you're not sure how they're going to handle disagreement, if you're not sure how to, you know, how much they're going to handle your beliefs, you can ask them about theirs and kind of see where, like, oh, I have common ground with this person. I think that if you can say, you know, you agree on certain things. You can find places where you both want the best, but you maybe you disagree. Maybe that person thinks that the best way to help the poor is welfare, and you think it's by, you know, a kind of a rising tide mentality. You know, you can have a disagreement there as long as you have a baseline ahead of time that both of you are good people who have, you know, the best interest of others in mind. And I think that when you can disagree vehemently about serious issues, if you both believe that about each other. And I think that that's what we miss so much for people who are kind of melting down as like a snowflake sort of thing, or kind of I think the male version of a snowflake is are the people who get up in your face and like flex and are like, you can't do that, you fascist, like yelling at somebody. Like, that's kind of the male version of it, is they don't break down and cry. They melt in a different way where it's, you know, you get all in someone's face acting like you're going to fight them. And I think that if you can show first that you're a good person who cares about them, who cares about others, you can have a conversation where you then disagree, where you tell someone you're a Trump supporter, maybe, if and they don't think that you're literally Hitler because of it. And I think that that's because I mean, I know definitely at work where people stand just based on comments that are made, but you know, I keep mine quiet. I'm sure that they probably have a feeling of where I stand on things, but I think, you know, they're definitely still good people. And while I'm not going to go out there and be like, here's why Trump's the best, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, I don't necessarily think he's the best. I think he has a lot of flaws that that could be better. But I think having that mutual understanding is important starting point for having those conversations. And when you do have the conversation about your beliefs, you know, being vulnerable about it and just saying like, look, this is where I am, this is what I believe, I think people will respect that if they respect you.
That's a great point. I think that the challenge is that a lot of people, you know, maybe they don't have that desire to understand someone else. I think it's perhaps a lack of openness. And I think it kind of ties to what you were saying before about being able to laugh about things. If you take yourself so seriously, if you aren't able to laugh at yourself, then, you know, how are you going to handle like criticism from someone else? I think that, you know, that's kind of why I think things are so polarized, is because when someone questions you and maybe you don't have the answer, you know, you kind of just get upset and like flex your muscles or, you know, scream or whatever, and get angry. And that seems to be like the common coping mechanism right now, is to just get triggered by someone else, something that someone says, or, you know, engage in what they call outrage porn, like just to, oh, look at this. Like, isn't this outrageous? Didn't you see this? Yeah, I think that's definitely something that I fall into myself is, you know, I feel strongly about abortion, for example. I don't think anything is going to change my mind about that. But, you know, maybe I can still be open to hearing what other people think. And, you know, because part of perhaps persuading someone is trying to understand where they're coming from as well. And, you know, maybe I'll learn something too. I think that perhaps part of the reason that I and a lot of other people might be hesitant to share things with people is I know what I believe. I know what I think is right, but maybe I don't know exactly how to explain that to someone else. Like, I like to read a lot of books, but I know what I learned from the books, but can I tell you and explain it to you? I don't know if I can. And yeah, that's just, it makes you uncomfortable when your views and beliefs are questioned. And yeah, it's just something that I certainly could grow in, and I'm sure a lot of other people could as well.
I definitely think it's tough. That's why I like the Catholic Answers podcast is a great place, especially if you want to hear how to have a charitable conversation with someone who is being incredibly uncharitable on the other end. They do the Why Are You Pro-Choice episodes. if you listen to Trent Horn do those, it's impressive how he kind of keeps his composure. He'll ask people to articulate the position and, you know, and he gets to the heart. He does a good job. And I think what he does there is he gets to the heart of what someone's saying, because they're saying, you know, oh, you know, it's just a parasite. And he'll say, oh, okay, so is that, it's not a human being in your body, right? Is what you're saying. And they're like, no, or it's a human being, but it's not a person. Or, you know, and you kind of poke and you see the distinctions that people are implicitly making in their beliefs, the more you ask questions and try to get to what someone is putting forward as their argument. And number one, you know, it's kind of goes back to that idea of charity, of you're helping people steel man their positions by doing that. And so they see that you're not attacking them, you're trying to understand them and you're helping them clarify what they mean. And then number two, you now know how to answer them with something that's substantive, that's going to ring a bell. And so for anyone out there who's like, yeah, and those, like, definitely there's times where I'm listening to him, I'm like, oh, why doesn't he just say this? It's because it's such an easy win. And then you're like, oh no, he's not trying to get an easy win. He's trying to understand this person and put forth really honest argumentation on why people should be pro-life. I think that that's definitely a good place to go to see that, because it's, and I think that it's tough to have those conversations with people who are angry, who are kind of melting down, who, whatever that is. And I think he does a good job as well of knowing when it's time to be like, okay, I don't think this conversation is going anywhere. I think we got other callers. We need to go to the next person to see what they're struggling with. And so I recommend that for sure as a place to go look. And Trent Horn is just good in general. He's also very good on Twitter at talking to people and kind of going back and forth in a good way that I think clarifies people's points in as much as you can do in, 280 characters or whatever it is.
Yeah, and we'll definitely, put those links in the show notes. I think you hit the nail on the head with a great example. And as we kind of wrap up this conversation, as we reach the hour mark, I think it's become clear, at least to me, that one of the issues I think a lot of men have, particularly on social media, with discussing politics or discussing things of a political nature, kind of like we said with the personal becoming the political, or and vice versa, it's that people put too much stock in the traditionally manly virtue of courage. And again, courage, fortitude is always great, but I think that there is a, when people feel like their identity is being threatened, they feel like the only virtue they need to invest in, they need to put all their chips into courage. It's like an RPG video game where you put all of your stats up in one column in courage and then everything else is zero. And in this particular case, it's prudence and justice. I mean, you could also say temperance, because you could say these people are not, maybe they're spending too much time on Twitter. Maybe they're not like balancing out their life. But I think the real question is, are these people who are, they are speaking the truth in many cases, are they acting prudently in what they're doing? I mean, you could post the truth a billion times, or I don't know, let's just say once every second on Twitter for, I don't know, a week or a year or whatever, but is that the right thing to do? I mean, like, why are you doing that? And I think that that is just kind of an exaggeration of what we see in many ways with our society. And really, when you think about, and you ask yourself the question, why are you posting on Twitter? And maybe I'll ask this more when you're talking about like political accounts versus, say, like Conversation of Our Generation and Vital Masculinity, which is more maybe promotional and kind of like involvement with community sort of thing. You're basically just trying to put your idea out there. So there's some level of personal pride, rightfully or wrongfully, that is being involved. And don't get me wrong, I think people that do analytics, people that do statistics, and people that do a lot of number crunching, like, these people are good. But I think it in many ways harkens back to what you have said on multiple occasions, Brian, which is, if I don't learn this now, or if I hear about this in a day or a week or whatever, will it really affect my life? And that's something I certainly struggle with, but I think that's a very good question for all of us to ponder this next week leading up to the election.
For sure. I think if you are in Twitter thinking, I need to convince this person of my point of view, or, you know, show this person the truth, you know, and meanwhile, you're at the dinner table and your wife or your child or your parent is sitting there across from you, I think you need to reevaluate things. And that's something that I catch myself every now and then. You know, my wife and I will sit down to watch a little bit of TV, and, you know, I bust out my phone and I check Twitter, and then all of a sudden, you know, I'm not watching a show with her. I'm in my phone. I think we can go overboard with trying to have a good conversation, change people's minds, kind of evangelize. You know, there's a point where you should do both, and you should do them at the right time, and knowing when the right time is important as well. And so that's definitely something that I, you know, struggle with, is finding those lines. But I think you can, I think it can be done. I think it can definitely be done, but I think that prioritizing that person next to you or the person in front of you is much more important than being right on Twitter. And the sooner we realize that, I think the sooner a lot of things will get better.
Yeah, it definitely takes a lot of vigilance. Mm-hmm. Stay on top of those things.
So, Brian, did you have any last questions to ask Nick here while we still got him on and while we're still having a conversation before next Tuesday?
Yeah, I did have one final question. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but how would you say having like important conversations on politics and, you know, philosophical, important philosophical issues, how important is that to being a virtuous man? And I don't know, maybe if you can summarize, like, I guess, how do you see that tying into being a virtuous man?
I think that if God really is truth, that seeking truth and trying to get closer to that is a virtuous endeavor. And the best way that we found to do that, in my opinion, is through dialectic, is through kind of that Socratic means of, I mean, obviously he was probably the best at doing that. Jesus didn't have to really, you know, learn things the same way that Socrates did. So I still kind of hold him up as the best because Jesus just knew it and taught it. one of the advantages of being God, and, and there's a lot more too, but I think that it is something that is virtuous in that sense. And so that's why I tried though, to kind of take it to the philosophical side of things and get to the underpinnings and the beliefs behind your political belief. Not, I believe in low taxes versus high taxes or more immigration versus less immigration. I want to know, you know, behind that, why is that the case? And I think when you get to that why, that's where you're starting to talk about how do we weigh different values, you know, one more important than the other? How do we then, you know, how do we apply principles of my Christian faith in the way I live with other people who may not share that faith? You know, those are, I think, serious questions about ethics that we have to get to. And then those build up to that political question. And so politics is kind of a good surface level thing that dives deeper into those questions of how can you be a good person, and what does that look like? And so the more I think we search for truth, the more we have conversations geared towards that, the better I think we will be, each of us as an individual and all of us as a society together.
I agree. That's good.
Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up this conversation. Nick, you're almost becoming a fixture here on the show, and in many ways, us and your project as well. It's always great to do the collaborations and get another you know, like-minded individual and gentleman in here. So we will, of course, put all of the links to your show, to your social media, all that stuff in our show notes, although I'm sure a lot of our listeners probably already know it by heart. Maybe they have it bookmarked. But thank you again so much for coming on, man. Do you have any final thoughts before we sign off?
Yeah, not much. Just I want to say thanks for having me on. And hopefully by the time, you know, next time we talk, we'll have put a lot of the craziness behind us and we can actually talk more about things that are Donald Trump and Joe Biden, and maybe dive more into what it takes to, I think the more important questions of how do you become virtuous? How do you change your life for the better in that way? So that's my hope.
Yeah, I did try to I did try to make on Teespring, you know, a joint conversation of our generation vital masculinity hat that was red with white text saying make political discussion great again, but it was just too big, and honestly I think we'd still get jumped for wearing something that looked like that. But maybe at some point in the future I can get the font really small and people will have to zoom in with a magnifying glass for that. But anyway, this has been such a fun conversation. Definitely check out the show notes. A lot to unpack here, so you may even need to listen to this twice. I'm sure, Brian, you and I will be probably going back and listening to this. But yeah, hopefully all of you guys stay sane, stay safe, and have a good, you know, couple of days before the election, since that's when this is going to drop. But we appreciate all of you guys listening. We appreciate all your support. Check out Nick's work, and always remember that virtue makes the man. Have a good one, gents.